You're listening to Freedom Train.
Online.com.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Freedom Train Online. This is the Prince Podcast with Michael D. We got an extra special show today. I'm a little excited. I'm trying to bring down my fanboyness just a little bit. I'm kind of geeked out. But we are joined today by Mr. Dez Dickerson. How are you doing, sir?
I'm doing great. How are you doing?
Man, I'm good. I'm blessed. So, you know, I can't complain.
All right.
Now, you know Dez. All you guys already know who Dez is, but I'm going to give him his proper introduction. Dez, he was the original guitarist for Prince and the Revolution. You recognize him. He's immortalized in classic videos like Little Red Corvette, 1999, of course, Dirty Mind videos, controversial videos. And then you also know him from the movie Purple Rain, where he came in the scene. He had the classic modern air scene in the movie. And we're going to get into that because I got some questions. Actually, a lot of the fans from the show got a lot of questions for you. But we're going to get into the modern era thing as well. But, man, it's just an honor to have you on the show, Dez. So just, woo, we're going to get this thing started and pack in as much as we can.
All right. Sounds good. Let's get at it.
All right. And then also, too, how can I forget? But Dez has a book out. It's been out for a couple years, if I'm not mistaken. My Time with Prince, Confession of a Former Revolutionary. And before we get started, I want to make sure that everybody knows where to get the book. Where can people buy this and purchase this book from, Dez?
The only place you can get it exclusively is at DezDickerson.com.
Okay. All right. So we want to make sure.
DezDickerson.com.
All right. We want to make sure everybody goes there. We're going to keep putting that out there throughout the show. All right, Dez. Man, I got a lot of questions, and I want to go back to the very beginning. Where are you from? Where were you born and raised?
Born and raised in St. Paul, Minnesota. Actually, technically, we moved to the suburbs of St. Paul when I was in fourth grade, so I grew up in a little town called Maplewood.
Oh, okay. And what was the upbringing like? I mean, you went to school out there. Did you have any connection or interactions with Prince or anybody or his friends, I don't know, Andre, whoever, before the whole music thing started? Or
not early on, no. I mean, one of the great things about the Twin Cities is the fact that you've got two completely sort of different, you know, characteristics, you know, town-wise as far as Minneapolis and St. Paul go. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, it's like one big city that's just separated by a river. So, you know, St. Paul was sort of the more provincial side, and Minneapolis, at least, you know, purportedly was the more sort of cosmopolitan side. And you know, as time went on, as you grow up, you become more mobile, and you got your own wheels, that kind of thing. You kind of become a citizen at large of the whole thing. But we really didn't cross paths at all until, you know, I auditioned for the band. Although I had started to hear rumblings about Prince probably about a year or so before we connected, just because I was very active in the local music scene and had been playing live and had, you know, led some popular bands kind of in both the city and the region. So, you know, okay, people started asking, hey, have you heard about this kid? You know?
All right. Tell me a little bit. I'm interested a little bit more about Minneapolis and St. Paul in terms of, you know, you, as myself, you're African-American. I don't think the African-Americans are predominant populace there. But what gets you into music? What got you into music, and what was the scene? You know, what was the dominant kind of music scene? Was there a certain type of genre that was, you know, being played, or what was that all about?
Well, first and foremost, I mean, my father was a musician before me. And okay, even though he had kind of put that all aside to raise a family, I mean, you know, one of my earliest recollections as a kid is, you know, waking up in the middle of the night and, you know, hearing music downstairs and coming down and kind of sitting on the stairs and watching, you know, like four guys stand in my living room playing saxophones at 2 a.m. or whatever. And even though my dad at that time worked like 2 jobs to support his family, he still found time to jam with friends and whatever. So I grew up around music. I mean, my dad had a huge record collection and listened to a lot of jazz, a lot of R&B, and you know, some kind of more pop things, you know. Mm-hmm. So, and I was obviously an avid radio listener and that type of thing. So, I mean, music was always part of life. And then the other thing that's unique, I mean, I kind of crack up when I hear people talk about diversity today, because one of the great things about the Twin Cities, especially at that time, was that even though, you know, the black population was relatively small, probably about 3 to 4% of the overall population, it was very much kind of a colorblind society in terms of the music and the cultural side. So in terms of going out and hearing live music, when I got into my teens and I was old enough to do that, I mean, a lot of the bands were you know, racially diverse, and you had, you know, black guys playing rock music, and you had white guys doing R&B, and it was like we didn't have those kind of barriers in our experience.
What got you to play the guitar? What got you into that instrument specifically?
It was just always something that I loved and was drawn to. I mean, I, you know, early on, my dad had like this King Curtis 45 that he used to listen to. And it was, I can't remember what the song was, but it was like one of his hits back in the day, probably, you know, early 60s, something like that. But I had, by that time, discovered how to use the turntable, and it got me in the habit of listening to B-sides, because I didn't want to hear the same song. I wanted to hear something new.
Right.
And on the B-side, there was this raucous kind of rock and roll thing that had guitar in it, and I was completely blown away by it. And, you know, between that and, again, this sort of multicultural mindset, you know, I used to watch with my family, we used to watch this TV show called Ozzy and Harriet back in the day.
Yep.
And, you know, Ricky Nelson was like, you know, the little brother that had the little combo that would play the garden party at the end of every show. And I was fascinated just by the dynamic of that. It wasn't even so much the music. It was like, man, you know, this guy gets up and he sings these songs and he plays this guitar and these girls swoon. It's like, this is really amazing, you know? So I've just kind of always been attracted to both sort of the power and the kind of, you know, both musically and sort of viscerally of the whole guitar thing.
Okay. And then last I wanted to ask in terms of that, like, learning an instrument, which, you know, is completely different. Well, it's in some degrees it's different now for, you know, a person may learn how to, you know, mess with the computer or turntables or some of that thing, but to actually learn to play an instrument, I mean, how long, what was your parents able to buy you a guitar, obviously, and then you took lessons, or how did you actually learn how to play?
It was really a process. It took place over a long period of time, and it really was like an extended family kind of an affair after a while. I mean, initially, you know, when I was really young, I just had, you know, one of these little cheap kind of plastic sort of, you know, semi-toy guitars. And when my folks saw how serious I was about it, they bought me a real, real inexpensive electric guitar. I mean, back in those days, they sold musical instruments at Radio Shack. So they bought me this, it was this Japanese guitar called a Xenon that was like $29.95 at the time. And, you know, I played that. And then at one point, you know, my mom, I think she was the one that really kind of realized first that there was something God-given there, that there was like some kind of aptitude there that was beyond just, you know, a kid that's fascinated by playing an instrument. And she got some information from somebody that what I needed was a better instrument if I was going to improve. So my folks talked to all their brothers and sisters and my entire family, aunts and uncles, pooled their money together to buy me like my first like real like Gibson guitar. At that point, I took lessons for about 6 months. But other than that, it was entirely self-taught. I would just do the needle drops on the turntable. I would take all my records of my favorite guitar players from, you know, Jimi Hendrix to, you know, Jimmy Page from Led Zeppelin to, you know, Eric Clapton, who was in a band called Cream at the time. And I would just, my whole thing was, if I can learn to play these solos note for note, then I'll know that I can do this. And that, it was just a matter of hours and hours and hours every day. I mean, 4, 5, 6 hours a day. Actually, at one point, my parents were worried about me. They thought that I was, that something was wrong with me.
Man, well, I say that I love that work ethic, because I mean, obviously that's what it takes to get to where you was
absolutely
at. Yeah. So
and I will say you don't see that as much in the young bucks today. I mean,
right.
Our culture has kind of given this instant mentality as kind mm-hmm. of a cultural narrative. So I see a lot of folks that, you know, want to pick up an instrument and do a photo shoot later in the week and send out 8 emails next week and somebody's going to make it a star. I'm like, you know, please.
Are we going to get into the music business of today? Definitely. So, okay. So you've gone to now. Let's move forward. We're going to move forward to when you actually auditioned for Prince. Now, I know this is touched on in the book, but I wanted to ask you, how old were you? At this time, how old were you when you started that audition?
I think, if I recall, I was either 21 or 22.
Okay.
Can't remember. I think it might have been 22. But, you know, by then, I had been doing my thing, like I said, locally and regionally for 9 years.
Okay.
So for me, I've been full-time at it for a while.
So you were doing a full-time musician, like you were playing shows and doing things of that nature?
Oh, yeah, I started when I was in high school, actually a sophomore in high school.
Oh, okay.
My parents used to have to write me notes to get out of school early on most Fridays because I had a band and we were booked by an agency. And, I mean, we were traveling through the upper Midwest pretty much every week.
Wow. All right. So that's one thing that fascinates me about you guys from the stuff I read. I'm like, these cats, you know, I obviously went through school and finished school, but it wasn't like, okay, let's go get a job. Or it was like they figured out what they wanted to do, and they just did it, like, at an early age.
Yeah.
To me, it's fascinating. So if you can touch on it, that first initial audition with Prince, I believe it was with Prince and Andre Simone.
Right. And Bobby Z was in the mix at that point, too.
What was that like? Now, you had heard of Prince at this point, to some degree.
Yeah. Like I said, he had been kind of a, you know, an urban legend around town. And I had heard about him because it was one of those things where, you know, I mean, the cats at the music stores and whatever, and just some of the folks around town. And one of the local music writers had mentioned him to me at one point in time. And then obviously when he got signed, that was news. Because even that whole thing, that whole aspect of, you know, record deals and people getting signed, I mean, that was all, that might as well have been, you know, nuclear fission to us. I mean, nobody knew anything about that. We just played music because we loved it and we wanted to make a living doing it and be the best we could possibly be. But anyway, what ended up happening was the audition process was just a matter of, there was Bobby and there was Andre and there was Prince and there were auditioning guitar players and keyboard players and, you know, I had heard about him. My younger sister had actually bought the For You album, so I had heard some of it. And that typical sort of youthful, you know, ego, I heard it and I thought, it's okay. But, you know, I could have made something better.
Right.
So it was kind of ironic when I'm in the room and Del's Tire and Martin were jamming, and you know, it's like, well, but my mindset at that point was, you know what? Obviously, this is the level of sort of seriousness and level of musicianship and level of, you know, drive that, mm-hmm. that I feel matches my own. So if this is the first train out of Dodge, I want to be on.
Right. Okay. So I want to go forward. You obviously you get this part. You're in the band, and the rehearsal process, was that something you talked about, you know, as far as the musicianship level and the attitude of, you know, pushing each other? Now, did you walk into this like, you know what, okay, wow, let me step up to what's going on? Or were you like, okay, these guys, I see them as somewhat of my equals. We kind of in the same space music-wise. Or, I mean, were you like impressed? Or what was that like, the rehearsal thing and playing amongst each other?
Yeah,
if you can elaborate on that.
Sure. I mean, it was definitely the latter. I mean, it was definitely, I had been, again, by that point, I'd probably been in 12 different bands over 9 years. And I was always, in fact, I had people tell me this, you know, across the years coming up, I would have people come up and say, you know, you're the motor and the rest of the band is the boat. I mean, you're the one that drives us. And behind the scenes, I mean, it was literally like most of the band that was in, I taught everybody else to play their parts.
Okay.
I taught the drummer to play the drums. I taught the bass player to play the bass part, because it was just like, you know, for me, that was second nature. But, you know, you make do with who and what you have. And but at the same time, at that level and at that age, you know, you're just happy to be doing it. You're having fun doing it. So it's not like, oh, here we go again. You know, the drummer can't pick up the groove from the record or whatever. Mm-hmm. So when I got into that situation, it was like, cool. I don't have to drag the piano uphill anymore, you know? And, the other thing was like that whole work ethic thing. I was always like the one from another planet, and everybody else was like, man, do we have to rehearse again? And I'm like, again, we're not rehearsing enough. It's not good enough yet. So I really think even going forward, one of the areas where we connected as far as Prince and I went was that it was the first time I've ever come across somebody that not only matched my level of intensity, but actually went beyond it. I mean, that was a first.
Wow. Okay. I want to move forward again, because I could keep you here all day, but I'm sure you can go more in depth in the book. But I wanted to fast forward again to the very first show that you guys did. I believe it was at the Capri Theater, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, sure was.
Talk to me a little bit about that, because from my readings of different things, I understand, obviously, it was the first concert you guys did together as a band, and one of Prince's first in terms of, you know, Prince the signed artist and stuff. What was that first show like?
Well, and yeah, you're right. I mean, I go into it in much greater detail in the book, but essentially it was a situation where the folks at Warner Brothers wanted to come and check on their investment. Mm-hmm. And, you know, at that point it was like they were either going to pony up a significant amount of sort of additional money at that time to put him on the road, to put us on the road in a significant way, after really the first record had been out for a good minute. It had been out for, I think, a year or more at that point in time. So it was already an unusual situation. He didn't tour behind the record, you know, either prior to the release or at the release, which was very unusual. So first and foremost, that was the purpose of the show. You know, just for us to get out of the basement, because we were a bit stir crazy by that time, because all we've been doing is rehearsing. So, yeah, I mean, it was about, you know, the major sort of decision makers at Warner flew in, you know, in the dead of winter in a minor. To them, it was a blizzard. To us, it was just sort of normal life in Minnesota in the winter. And that's what it was about. And also to help this man that owned the Capri and was kind of a fixture in the community in terms of being, you know, kind of one of those guys that really was a champion of young people in North Minneapolis and that kind of thing. For Prince, it was a matter of helping him out.
Oh, okay. Okay.
It was a benefit show.
Then, so actually, before I go in back into that, who were some of the people, who were the people that were around, like, I'm reading of a gentleman, and I'm going to try and get him on the show. I think his name was Pepe or Pepe or what? You know what I'm talking about?
Pepe, yeah, Pepe. I just saw Pepe a few months back. Yeah, well, what it was is Pepe was a former brother-in-law. He, at one point, was married to one of Prince's, I think it was actually his half-sister. So, you know, they had remained tight because Pepe came from a music background. He had an uncle that was in Little Anti-Union Imperials. And so, you know, Pepe had kind of been, you know, a guy that had come along and was knowledgeable about, you know, music publishing and some different things, and had kind of stepped in and augmented kind of the structure that was built around him management-wise and other things.
Okay.
And then at the point where Prince fired our manager, You know, Pepe provided just a place for us to rehearse. We rehearsed in his basement, and you know, he kind of stepped in to do some administrative things in the interim and that kind of thing.
Okay. And just going back to that rehearsal thing again, I mean, what was like a typical day? Would you guys do, you know, 5 days a week? You know, was it, you know, 5 hours, 6 hour sessions? What was that like?
I mean, at that point, it was 5 days a week, and we were, you know, probably only doing, you know, 3 or 4 hours a day at that point in time. And it would definitely increase as time went on, but, you know, anywhere between 2 and 4 hours, as I recall, which, again, for me, the background I come from, that was what I had always tried to provoke. So that was cool.
All right. And we're going to just jettison a little forward into the future again. So you guys are on tour, and I wanted to ask about the tour. I think it was the Dirty Mind. What was the tour where you guys were with Rick James?
We were definitely touring the Dirty Mind record at that point in time. Because we'd started out, we did a sort of a handful of showcase dates where it was just us or us headlining, and then we jumped on the Rick James tour. That I believe was the Fire It Up tour.
Okay. Now, I was a youngin' back then, obviously, but over the years, you hear about, you know, some sort of, as they say in the streets now, beef, or there's some sort of, you know, thing going on between Rick James and Prince or whatever. And then I actually have read Rick's book. I don't know if you read his memoir that he came out with.
I haven't. I need to. I haven't.
Yeah, it's pretty good. And obviously it's him saying it, but he has a whole thing in there about Prince and stuff and the tour and just his point of view, what was going on. I'm curious, you were there, you're in the band. Did you see any sort of, you know, ruffle feathers or, you know, uncomfortableness between your guys' camps? Or were you aware of any of that?
Well, I mean, yeah, but the real story on the inside was that as far as the bands go, the people in both bands, we were actually very tight. And in fact, over the course of the last, you know, year or two, you know, I've reconnected with several of the folks that were in the Stone City band and even on the crew at that point in time. With respect to what, you know, what was sort of turned into this legend of there being, you know, this beef between Rick and Prince, what it really was were two guys that were very driven, very competitive, and like a lot of artists who have that sort of chemistry, that inner chemistry that it takes to be a star. A friend of mine described it this way, and I realized that it's right on the money, and it also, different times in my life, has described me to a T. It's an egomaniac with an inferiority complex. That's usually, if you kind of drill down inside the psyche of a star, that's usually what's there. So you had two guys that fit that description, and because of that insecurity, there'd be a whole lot of reacting to things that didn't happen. And because of the fact that it was compounded by us going out every night, I mean, night after night, and absolutely positively just slaying them. I mean, I got to the point where I felt bad that they had to follow us. It was just one of those things, because we were just doing something that on that particular, at the time, the R&B arena circuit, there was nobody that had ever done what we were doing.
Right.
So we were completely, like, you know, annihilating people. But what happened was, yeah, I mean, there got to be this rift that was more about what wasn't being said between them and what was being thought, but that was unfounded, that was causing it to get worse and worse. And what actually happened, this is the part that didn't become public, but me and Bobby Z just went to Rick's room and talked to him, like, late at night, one night on the road, like 3 in the morning. And just spent about an hour just talking and said, hey, you know what? I mean, we just really, all we want to do is just kind of foster some communication. Because it was one of those, well, it was like a stare down. I was like, well, I'm not going to go to him. And, well, I'm not going to go to him. And so I just said, well, this is silly. Because, I mean, I can see both sides of it. And I like both of these guys. And I think they're both good people. So, you know, I just said, let's just, you know, and we talked to I think it was Rick's road manager, and said, hey, you know, we just want to sit down with Rick. And Rick was cool. I mean, I loved Rick. Now, he was just a down-to-earth, I mean, like everybody, you know, you got the public image and you got the thing that,
right,
that you know, earns the paycheck. But, I mean, he was a good dude.
Yeah, I'll let you read the book. He has very interesting incidences in there. I don't remember all of them, but I kind of get the same impression you get. You got two guys. One, from what I can imagine, it seems like at the time, Rick was probably everybody knew who Rick James was. Like, I knew who Rick James was at that time, you know. And then Prince, this the new guy coming up. And like you said, I mean, he's just coming out of nowhere. It seems almost out of nowhere with this whole new show and this, the whole look and everything. And I can imagine how, you know, that's like, wait a minute, who is this guy?
You know? At some level, he knew he was being knocked off. You know, he could see the handwriting on the wall. And the other thing is, I mean, I say it this way. Envy, if it would talk, envy would say, I don't want you to have the thing that I want. And the other factor in that was there was an envy with respect to Rick, I believe, really, and, you know, there's nothing wrong with it. He wanted to be like that big crossover star that hadn't happened yet at the level that we would see not too, you know, much later with both Michael and Prince. That was something that Rick really wanted. And I think what he began to see is Prince was going to achieve that, and he probably wasn't. And I think that was in the mix.
Yeah. Last thing I add, because even in the book, he talks about like when they were going to different cities and they would see Prince's promo materials all over the place. And Rick was like, man, I don't see anything from my, you know, Motown or whatever the situation wasn't really doing it right. And, you know, I'm sure there's other factors, but yeah, he definitely even speaks on that. Okay. So that's good. I wanted to hear about that. I can imagine seeing a show like that, like where you got Prince, Rick James. That's probably, I call that a headbuster. Like, I don't know if I've been to handle that.
And the other amazing thing about that tour that gets lost in the mix is we had Lenny White and 29. And at the time, you know, Lenny had been the drummer in one of my favorite fusion groups, Chick Corea and Return to Forever. But he had in his band these amazing players, including, and I can't believe I'm blanking on my man's name because we just recently reconnected on Facebook too, but he played guitar on, you know, the Run DMC rock box thing. He played guitar on the Robert Palmer, the huge hits, you know, Addicted to Love and all the other stuff. And I can't believe I'm blanking on his name. I apologize if you hear this. But anyway, I mean, there were just amazing cats in that band.
Oh, wow. Okay. And another question, this is a Dirty Mind specific thing. I wanted to talk about the content of the songs, you know, songs like Head, Sister, and things of that nature. And from my readings and stuff, it seems as if there was some sort of, you know, uncomfortableness, maybe on your part and maybe other band members too, of playing some of these songs. You know, was there any truth to that? Was it kind of like, because I look at it this way, like I listen to these songs. Now, yeah, I mean, classic songs and I love them, but as an older person that I am now, I can imagine even from Prince or whoever, I look at those songs now, it's like, yeah, okay, that's where a person was at that time. But I can look, I kind of cringe sometimes when I hear them just because like, wow, what they're talking about is some wild stuff, but yeah, it's all great. But you were out there playing the music. How did you feel? Did you feel any sort of way like, okay, do I believe in this stuff? Or, you know, any contradictions? How did your family feel about some of that stuff?
Well, I mean, it was all of the above. I mean, it was also something that built up and kind of snowballed over time. But there was a high level of uncomfortability. I mean, for one thing, I mean, we're talking, you know, almost 30 years ago for some of that stuff.
Sure.
And at that time, that was so far over the top that management, the label, everybody was nervous about it at some level. And also it was a different era culturally and socially. And I don't think we realize how sort of numb and anesthetized we've become as a society over the course of the last 30 years when it comes to some of those kinds of things. So it was definitely, in fact, I just had this conversation with somebody the other day that it was definitely one of those things that, you know, you take your mom aside before she comes to the show and says, okay, now on the third song of the set, you're going to want to get up and go get a Coke right there for about 5 minutes and then come back in. I mean, seriously, it was like, I would even arrange to have like people come get my folks and take them out for some popcorn for a minute in a couple spots of the show. Because it was like, you know what, you don't want to be doing stuff like this. This is disrespectful.
Bro, okay.
It over time, it became more and more an issue for me personally. But at the same time, the thing for people to understand is it was never serious. It was all marketing from day one. From the moment the plan was hatched in the dressing room at the Roxy in LA, it was always about marketing. That's all it was.
Wow. So, well, I'm curious if you want to talk about why it was an issue for you. What changed, you know, to make that more of a I don't know if it's a problem or if that's the wording I put out there, but
I really had, even at that point in time, just a real sense of the gravity of how what you do impacts other people.
Okay.
One of the things I say now is that, you know, that thoughts, ideas have consequences, and that words mean stuff. And I, at times, increasingly would look out in the audience and see somebody with like their 8 or 9 year old and think about the things we were singing about and the things we were doing on stage and thinking, now would I want my 9 year old daughter out seeing someone else do this?
Right.
No, I wouldn't. And increasingly, I began looking at it through that window. And then there was a point specifically in my life. And this is also something that, you know, the full story is in the book, where I had, you know, like a lot of folks, I had grown up in church, but, you know, sitting in a bread basket doesn't make you a biscuit. I had grown up in church, but I had, you know, pretty much walked away from it instead, you know, later on, I'm doing something else.
Mm-hmm.
But later on, I had a kind of a reawakening in it, and it was while I was in the band. So that was kind of the deal breaker for me. I couldn't get past the fact that we may not be serious about this, but other people are taking it seriously.
Right.
And I don't want to contribute to the mindset that this is just, you know, lifestyle business as usual.
Okay. Wow. So the dirty, I wanted to ask you this, that album, obviously, it's, you know, landmark album within his career and in music at that time. Did you guys, when you heard that record, and I don't know how much you actually contributed to that particular one, but when it was done, did you guys look back and be like, because this obviously is very different from the album before it, and in some ways it kind of introduces the Prince that we kind of had started to understand. This is Prince, like just the look and the music and the themes and stuff. Did you guys know that this record was special and very, very different from what was going on at the time?
Well, I mean, we knew that it was very different from what was going on at the time. And I think everybody had their different kind of facet of it that they embraced. For me, the thing that was exciting about it is I was the rock and roll guy.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that, as you know, kind of our working relationship and friendship developed, Prince and I just tried to turn him on to as much of the new wave and the punk stuff that I was excited about at that time as I possibly could. Because I knew that he, you know, we shared, I mean, some of our favorite bands, you know, coming up were rock bands. Like, we both loved Grand Funk Railroad back in the day. So I was just really excited about trying to push further in that direction. So for me, that record was a triumph in that regard, in that we became much more of a rock band at that point than we had been before. But in terms of the significance of it, you know, you never really have a full grasp of the significance of anything at the time when you're that age. I mean, hopefully later in life, you can recognize the moment more readily. But, you know, a lot of things went on. I mean, that record was almost the end rather than the beginning,
right,
on a lot of fronts behind the scenes. So,
One thing, I wanted to go back to that Rockbox thing. Were you thinking of, was it Eddie Martinez? Was that the guy's name?
Eddie, I just, okay. Just before you started, I remember, yeah, Eddie Martinez.
Okay, cool.
Great guitar player, great guy. Like I said, we just reconnected. He's out on the West Coast now. And,
right on.
Good dude.
Okay. So going into Controversy album days and things, I wanted to, now this is, and I want to say the Time record. That's what I wanted to ask you about. The Time, the first Time album, which actually is the first time that I actually heard Prince music. I didn't know who Prince was, but I heard Get It Up. I went to Houston and I heard that on the radio, and that's all. The streets of Houston, Texas were nothing but the Time, Prince, and Roger Troutman. And it's a couple questions. One, I wanted to ask you, was there at any point where you guys started to realize, like, I don't like to say the word stars, but it started like, you know what, we kind of doing it big right now. Like, was you kind of, can you tell from the audience, like, man, we actually out here doing this thing? Because, like, when I went to Houston in 81, I don't know, you know, I'm curious what you thought of this, but I had never really, back then, radio was very different in every city, right? So certain songs in the East Coast weren't playing on the West Coast. I'm from Seattle, so we didn't hear nothing about you guys' music. But when I went to Houston, like I said, it was just as if, you know, how they have 50 Cent or Jay-Z now, where every car is playing them songs and it's just boom, boom, blasting. That's how y'all music was at that point. And I'm curious, did you guys know the impact of what was going on from your whole movement and stuff?
The reality is, and the funny thing is, it's kind of like, you know, you can maybe sense, if you're in the right place or sensitive enough or whatever, sense the earthquake before the real big shock comes. Mm-hmm. For us, it started at a specific point in 1979. And we had just done American Bandstand and just, you know, performed I Want to Be Your Lover and a couple of things from the second album, which, you know, at that time, that was when they still thought they had, like, you know, the young Stevie Wonder / Smokey Robinson. And he was beginning to show, no, that's not where this is headed. But we did a show at a little theater called The Rainbow in Denver. It's a 1,500-seat, you know, it was a purpose-built facility for, you know, sort of intimate music events. And it was right after we'd been on American Bandstand, and there was a full-blown, like, Beatlemania riot after the show. I mean, we literally had to be whisked away. First of all, the police had to rescue us. The dressing room was in this, like, portable out behind the theater, and they had to physically take us from the portable into the car and get us out of there. And there was a high-speed chase with this caravan of fans chasing us through residential neighborhoods on icy roads at like 70 miles an hour. It was crazy.
That's funny.
So at that point, we knew, this is like, we're doing what we had dreamed about doing, and it's actually not only working now, but this is just the beginning. So for us, the rest of it was fait accompli. By the time everybody else caught up, and again, it's just some of the arrogance of youth, but by the time everybody else caught up, we were like, well, it's about time. You know, we did wait. I mean, we knew that this was coming. We just were waiting for you to know that it was coming.
Oh, okay. You mentioned the American Bandstand performance. Now, that was a classic performance, and actually more so classic when Mr. Dick Clark comes up to Prince to do the interview thing. When that was immediately over, I mean, did you guys, were y'all like, what are you doing? Like, I mean, was there any discussion of what just happened? Did you
I chronicled that in the book. All of that was premeditated and discussed just prior to us going on.
Interesting. Okay.
And it's definitely, you know, I would just say, hey, get the book, read it, because that's probably one of the most interesting stories out of the whole thing.
Okay.
But that thing was, we knew just prior that was going to happen. Not that we were happy about it, because it was like, we're going to do what? But
Yeah, that's some funny stuff. And if you guys haven't seen it, you can probably see it on YouTube and different things. But it's hilarious. I'll just say that. All right.
And later on, years later, I got to say this. Dick Clark, on one of his, 50th anniversary show or whatever, said that by far the most challenging interview he ever did in all of his years was with Prince. And then he goes and tells his perspective on that story and how that happened.
Wow.
So right. It had an impact on Dick as well.
All right. I was going to ask you about the time, but actually there's a project before that that was never released. But again, like I say, you got a real hardcore Prince situation here. So I got to ask you about this. Do you remember the project? I think it's called The Rebels. Is that?
Yeah, absolutely.
I was just
talking with Bobby B about it last week.
Well, okay. How come that didn't come out, man? What happened?
A number of things. I mean, it's one of those things where ultimately it was between Prince and management. I mean, management wanted us, and label wanted us, to get on with the real agenda, which was, the making and breaking of Prince as a solo artist and as a star and us as a band. And they viewed that as a distraction. And I think because like a lot of creative people, for Prince, as time went on, kind of the energies that he had put in that project and the vision that he had for it was kind of transferred to Vanity Six and The Time and some of the other things that happened subsequently.
Okay.
But it was a moment in time. I guess that's the best way to say it.
Yeah. I remember when I first heard it, I was like, what? Like, why? I was like, wow. Okay. There's just so much music going on, obviously, with the whole situation. And I'm just like, wow. Okay. Dang, they had this.
It was conceived to be a real band collaboration.
That's what it sounded like.
It was almost his way of tipping his hat to the rest of the band and saying, hey, I want everybody to come to the table and have ownership of this. And that's what it was. So Andre brought his bit to the table. I brought my bit to the table. We really had to do our thing much more so than the role that we played and we're comfortable with respect to the Prince thing.
Okay. The first time album, now, am I correct that you did After High School? Was that your song that you contributed?
Yeah, I wrote that song.
Wow,
yeah.
Okay. Interesting. And then you wrote the lyrics to Cool. Is that right as well?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Prince called me when they were kind of finishing up the record and said that he needed some lyrics. He just had the title Cool. And by that point in time, he had respect for just my lyric writing ability. Mm-hmm. He just said, hey, can you write some lyrics for this? So I said, yeah. I called him back almost exactly 15 minutes later and said, here you go. gave him the lyrics, and that was that. And we ended up doing the same thing on the next record with the song Wild and Loose. He called me with the title, mm-hmm. and I called him back. That one took a little longer. I think that one took me about 40 minutes. I called him back, gave him the lyrics.
So, like, in the Cool song, obviously, that's like as a fan looking into it, not knowing anything else, it just sounds like, man, that's just Morris Day, pimp, that's the pimp player, the whole thing. But that's you coming up with that whole, did he tell you, like, okay, this is the style that it's supposed to be in, that some of the things it's supposed to be about, or how was that whole thing working?
It was a real simple one phrase thing. But at that point we knew that the image that at least the general direction of the image that he was going for with Morris was this, again, the cool thing.
Okay.
And it was just a matter of, we need to write a song for that. And so I just lyrically put out there what I thought it was. But a lot of it, so much of that had grown out of what we were doing and kind of where we were at and even what we were at the time. Even that phrase, ain't nobody bad like me, came from this throw-off line. We were in a car with with one of the promo guys from Warner Brothers on a West Coast swing, and it was one of those things where we would talk about how how bad the promo guy was, because he knew everything. He had a big screen TV and an Atari before anybody had one. That's why I was like, man, Ted, you bad. And I started doing this thing in this voice. You bad, Ted. Ain't nobody bad like you bad, Ted. And it became like this running joke. And then it worked its way into the record.
Oh, okay. Wow. That's funny. Okay. That's exclusive, hopefully. Oh, see, you reminded me of so many things. I want to back way, go to controversy again. One other question. I think it was called The Second Coming. You guys started shooting some sort of concert movie back then or something?
We shot and they edited an entire live concert film, yeah, that also never came out.
Wow. Why do you think that didn't come out? I'm just, you know, as a fan, I'm just like, we need that.
I have no idea. I mean, there were a lot of things. I mean, part of that was, and then probably still is to some degree, just Prince's process. He had and has such tremendous creative energy mm-hmm. that he would, his MO was, sometimes it was just kind of ready, fire, aim. And I mean that in a positive way, not in a negative way. He was just like, in a moment, get the idea out, get started on it, get in motion. And sometimes by the time it was finished, he was on to something else.
Okay.
And the timing was no longer right from his perspective.
All right.
But yeah, in fact, you know, the other sort of little tidbit there is Bobby Z's brother, not David to be the producer, but his other brother edited the film. And he's to this day a real successful film editor.
Oh, okay. All right. And was this, obviously Prince came with another concert film many years later, The Sign of Times thing, but did this have any sort of story or acting type segment, vignettes? And I mean, I heard rumors of different things, but you've seen it.
There were some little vignettes. I mean, there was a little thing, there was a little game that we ran on our favorite entertainment writer at the Minneapolis paper, this thing that we did, you know, in the dressing room at the show in Minneapolis. And there were some little small vignettes like that, but not you know, any major dramatic okay. kind of stuff.
All right. Another time question quickly. Just going back to the live element, specifically, I guess, going into 1999 a little bit. But we hear all the different talk about the time, sometimes going out there, killing it, opening up for you guys. Was it really like that? Was the time a problem sometimes to follow behind them? Or what was the thing about that?
Well, I mean, you know, again, I think that sort of folklore and urban legend is one thing and reality is another. It was meant to be stiff competition because we kind of created the time to be just that.
Sure.
But I think that as far as Prince's expectation, I think they went above and beyond it to the point where it was kind of like the Frankenstein's monster thing. It's like, whoa, this was a little bit more successful than I expected it to be. And there were some aspects of it that he didn't expect. But, I mean, that was, again, we were wired that way. So we wanted them to go out every night and eat it up so badly that, you know, we could not ever phone it in, you know?
Okay. You know, I just wanted to add, I mean, some of my favorite stuff is that the first and second time record. And I remember, like, you know, we used to be on the bus and there would be arguments about, like, who was better, you know, not knowing that it all came from the same person. It's just fascinating to me, like, what do you, and I'm going to ask you this, it's a hypothetical question, but what do you think would have happened if Prince had to put that stuff out himself? And do you think it would have?
Well, it never would have happened because he was, from a business perspective and a marketing perspective, savvy enough to realize by that time that there were some, as there are as is the case with a lot of artists, some different sort of facets to who he was mm-hmm. and what he was able to do. And he did not want to be pigeonholed in just sort of a pure, you know, stank, down and dirty R&B kind of way. So he wanted to have an outlet for that,
right.
But he didn't want to be pigeonholed by that.
Okay.
So there's no way that he would have done that stuff himself.
Okay. Now we're going to just talk a little bit about 1999 because I want people to get the book, but The course of this album being made, it's a double album. I think you got obviously really getting into the whole crossover thing in terms of, you know, different types of songs in there, and it's such an expansive piece of work. The song "Little Red Corvette." What was the recording process like during that? Was that something you guys were working on together, or did you just came over and did your parts? Do you anything you remember about that specifically about the recording of that song?
I mean, he pretty much at the point where he started to incorporate the band into making records, it was still a modular thing. I mean, where he pretty much, if you equated it to, you know, architecture, I mean, he kind of laid the foundation and framed it out and, you know, finished out some of the interior and left some parts unfinished and called in, you know, the rest of the band one by one as kind of subcontractors to do the finishing work. That's the best description of it. So, yeah, so it was definitely, in terms of our contribution, individually, it was piecemeal. I mean, I got a call, went over one afternoon, and did all my stuff on the record in one day. So the vocals and the guitar stuff on 1999, the vocals and guitar stuff on Little Red Corvette.
Okay.
It was all in one afternoon.
And I got to add in here, too, and I'm sure you know this, but Guitar World, they have you listed as the 64th of the 100 greatest guitar solos for Little Red Corvette. That's pretty amazing.
Yeah, that was an exciting thing. Actually, the summer that came out, by that time, I mean, I had my own label and was entrenched on the business side, and one of my bands was doing a show in a town about 40 minutes out from where I live now. And, you know, as I, you know, got out and was walking towards an outdoor show, as I was walking toward the backstage, one of the guys came running up to me with that issue of the magazine. Did you see this? And it was, I mean, it still is. For me, that's probably one of the things that I'm most proud of over all the years of my career, because, you know, I mean, there's some heavyweight people in that 100 solos that they picked out. I mean, I remember opening the magazine and looking, and man, there's Jimi Hendrix, there's Jimmy Page, there's what am I doing on the same page with these other people? So, and jokingly, in the years since, on a couple of projects that I produced or co-produced but didn't want to overshadow the artist whose record it was, I used the pseudonym Number 64.
Ah, interesting. Okay. We're going to leave the whole 1999 discussion and, like, why you decided to step away from the situation. You got to get the book, okay? Because I don't want to...
Absolutely.
Yeah, I don't want to take away from that. What was I going to ask you? And I know you cover this in the book, and I had a ton of questions some people were asking, but we've been here for an hour. I don't want to keep you here too long, but if you can, just a little bit, the Rolling Stone concert situation. I mean, was it as bad as it is glamorized in, you know, the stories of chicken wings flying and all that type of stuff? Or was it just like, okay, got booed?
And, you know, funny, because I mean, there are some things, a lot of things that turn into folklore, and it gets, you know, it gets embellished over time. That's the one situation where no, that wasn't embellished at all. I mean, it was every bit. Although some of the, I think what gets left out is really that first 20 minutes, the first day, because we did two shows, 2 days or 1 day apart. The first 20 minutes, that first show, that first day, was still probably, you know, if not the most amazing 20 minutes of my life, definitely in the top 10 somewhere. It was just that there were a lot of things that transpired between that and the end of the second show that, that's another one of those things where, yeah, you need to read the book just to get the details on that.
Okay. Let's see. The one last question here. I wanted to ask, and you brought his name up earlier. You brought up Michael Jackson, and I wanted to ask you you are, obviously you were in the Prince camp. You guys are doing your own thing. But was there any? Obviously, you can't not know that Michael exists. Obviously, you know, Off the Walls, killing him, Thrillers, killing him. What was there any type of like? Okay, we acknowledging what's going on. Like, did you guys ever even like jam to some of his music? I mean, I'm just throwing stuff out there. But was there any like conscious thing of we don't want to do what Michael's doing? Or any, did I even come into the picture at all? Any conversation?
The best way I can describe it, there was, especially back in the day when radio was more of a factor than it is now, sometimes you would have this phenomenon where, you know, one of the marquee artists came out with a record at a specific sort of period of time with the expectation that, you know, the single or the album, whatever, it's going to at some point hit and occupy the number one spot. But then you have the situation where there's someone blocking you, where there's someone sitting at number one and you just can't dislodge them. Mm-hmm. And to a great degree, that was kind of the vibe between Prince and Michael. The same dynamic that took place between Rick and Prince, much more so at a distance, I think, was at work. Because, again, you got guys that are extremely, extremely competitive, mm-hmm. extremely driven, want to be number one, period. They can't both be number one. So was there a subtle rivalry? I would say a subtle internalized. It wasn't overt. It wasn't outward. Did it get talked about from time to time? Yeah, it came up from time to time. You know what I think for me, and I'm going to share this because this has more to do with me than Prince, but it tells a story.
Okay.
After I left the band, I was doing my Modern Airs solo thing. I'm the special guest on the Billy Idol Rebel Yell tour, playing a show in Fresno, California. I come off stage after my set's done, and I, at that point, I have the same management as Prince does. And the woman from the management company who was on the road with us came up to me within minutes after I got off stage and said, hey, wanted to tell you, you know, we got a call from Michael Jackson's office this afternoon. He wanted to come out to see your show, but we told him, no, we didn't want to have to babysit.
Interesting.
So there was a subtle attitude that kind of permeated of competition to some degree, and I think that story kind of underscores what that was about.
Right.
And yes, I was very angry. We'll just leave it at that.
Well, see, now you just said that, I was like, another part of me could see, it'd been controversial or whatever, take it how you want. I could have seen the bad tour, and I could see you up there. I could see. I leave it at that. But yeah, I could definitely see that. Interesting. Well, just another thing, it's kind of funny, but I'm sure you've seen it, but was there ever any discussion about the James Brown appearance that both of them did together, Michael and Prince, on the stage at one point?
Never any discussion, because I'm trying to remember chronologically. I think I was out of the band by that time.
Okay.
Funny, though, just this weekend, my son and I talked about that, because it was my son that actually turned me on to that on YouTube,
yeah,
you know, years ago. And we just brought that up and were telling some friends about it this past weekend and, like, trying to Google it, trying to find it, because they hadn't seen it before. But
That's an odd bit. Nervousness, obviously, you're up there with James Brown. I was watching Prince on that, and I was like, man, I was trying to figure out where he was going, and maybe just the guitar wasn't plugged in. I don't know what was going. It's a hysterical.
Yeah, I have no idea, and it's one of those things where it's, hey, I have no idea. It's none of my business, and I think, man, if every moment of my public life were filmed and archived,
sure,
how many of those moments would there be where people would be going, where was he going with that? For me, it'd probably be two or three times a day. It'd be one of those, what? Where is he going with that?
All right. The Modern Airs. Again, I throw this question. Why did that not come out? Because when it came on in the movie Purple Rain, listen, we all sitting in that theater, and you come on there and your song, and it was like, oh, that's all boy from 1999, and then the music was pumping, and like everybody was doing the dance, and I was like, what the hell? Like, you had your whole movement was about to blow up, man. Like, we've been waiting. I was like, where is this record? Like,
oh yeah,
what happened with that, man?
You know, that's one of the age-old questions, and there are. It's almost like people are still trying to figure out the Kennedy assassination, but a morbid parallel, but an accurate one. But essentially, man, it was like, you know, at the time, first of all, when we filmed it, we filmed like almost 5 minutes that survived, as I understand it, every edit of the film except the final edit. So it went from 5 minutes down to 18 seconds in the final cut. Secondly, it was supposed to be a synchronized promotional effort at the time. We took a hiatus from the road with I've been doing a headline tour for 2 months, and then we had connected with Billy Idol, had just started doing dates on the Rebel Yell tour. We took a break from the Idol tour to come back and film our segment, take one day to film our segment in Purple Rain. That our single, Modern Era, was supposed to have been released just before we went back on the road. Mm. Warner Brothers was, I signed the paperwork. They had me do a B-side for the record. Oh. And had me approve an edit of the B-side. I had, when I was on the road with Billy, I had radio people coming backstage asking, hey, when is the single going to come out? You know, we got the advance, we got the advance copy, but they keep pushing the release date back. Like I said, at that time I was managed by Prince's people, and who knows? I don't know if it was a label decision, even though I got a call from their business affairs department a year and a half after the fact, after it was initially supposed to be released at the time of the Billy Idol tour and the time of the film Purple Rain. Still, 18 months later, I got a call again. Okay, now we're going to release it. What happened? I don't know. I don't know if it was a label decision. I don't know if it was something that was a management decision. But it affected a lot of different things. A lot of things got out of sync because initially it was supposed to be on Warner Brothers and I was supposed to be on Warner Brothers. Mm-hmm. At the point where that didn't happen, we started shopping to other labels. At one point, every major label on the planet was, you know, throwing parties and taking me to dinner and doing this and doing that. And, you know, it's one of those great music business mysteries. To this day, I really don't know what happened other than the fact that it just never came out.
Oh, man, that's whack. Like I said, it was such a great moment. I'm just like, I mean, I would ask, I mean, like that dancing and all that stuff they were doing, I mean, was that, you set all that up, and was it, I mean, it just looked like y'all had the
time. No, the choreography, that part of it was really something that the folks connected directly with the film came up with, and I think it was Prince's general vision to have one moment in the movie where the whole audience is doing some kind of, you know, coordinated, choreographed dance move. Okay. And I think he was the one that came up with the idea to have him do it during my song.
Ah, man, it just seemed like, it was like you wanted it to be longer. And like, you know, even like the dialogue parts that are speaking over the music, it's just etched in our brain. Like, I just know every little segment of that. It's just like, man. Well, now, of course.
Now, that song was originally supposed to be on the soundtrack album. There was supposed to be a true soundtrack album with all the music from the film on the album. But after the principal filming, Prince kept writing stuff.
Right.
And they kept adding more music, and they kept going back and laying some of this new music back into the film. So it ended up being a Prince album and not a soundtrack album.
Okay. I want to ask you about some of the albums you have released yourself. One Man, which came out in 1999. Now, was that your first solo album?
Yeah, that was my first true solo album. There was a lot of material that I had recorded during that period of time, you know, kind of between Modern Era, kind of going under witness protection, and and all the, you know, the miscues and misfires with signing with labels and then not signing with labels. So now that material I did end up subsequently releasing years later as a double CD set of unreleased material. But One Man was, it was first. And at this point, technically the only true studio right. solo album that was intended from the get to be a solo album.
Okay, and then you came out with Rock of Ages, where classic hymns meet classical.
Well, what
rock.
It is that there was a project. See, I've done a bunch. You know, there are over 100 records that I've been involved in over wow. the years, and a lot of them people have no idea that I was involved. Like I said, I mean, they're projects I've even produced under the name Number 64. Rock of Ages was a project that a friend of mine came to me with. He's with a company that does instrumental compilations and sometimes vocal and instrumental compilations of that are sort of stylistically themed. You know, they'll take, and that one was classic hymns, but done in a rock style. So that was just one of those things where I produced it, arranged it, you know, engineered it, mixed it. And it was a combination of just a side project and kind of a labor of love, you know, because it was one of those things where a lot of those old hymns were, you know, mm-hmm. just had been a part of my life and a part of the lives of a lot of people that I've known. But I actually had my own, still had my own label. So, you know, we released 22 titles over a 7 or 8 year period through that label. I was VP of A&R, another label 5 years before that. Okay. And there's a lot of work that I've done with and for other people. Play on, you know, Aretha Franklin's True Way of Love back in the day.
Really?
There's just a lot of stuff that I've been involved in, a lot of which is just not general or public knowledge.
Wow, okay. A few more questions.
Played on Bret Michaels from Poison, played on his solo record.
Really? Man, you got to have a discography up on your site. It breaks it all down, and that would.
I know. We it got to the point where it's like, you know, the people that are really kind of digging and getting all the dirt, they'll find it out and figure it out. But right. we just haven't, and maybe that's something we'll do here in the next, sometime in this next year. We'll get some of that archive stuff together.
Okay, a few more questions. Do you have maybe like 10 more minutes, 10, 15 minutes? Is that cool?
Yeah, I can probably do about 10 more.
10? Okay, all right. I wanted to ask you, I wanted to ask you about the music industry as it is today, because I understand that you are in the business, and I'm curious, because obviously it's a totally different place than it was, if you want to go all the way back to 79 or even after that, even last 10 years. Where do you see the business now? Two questions. Where do you see it now? And the second one is, if you, Prince and Revolution, came out today, would you guys make it to even the third album? Would they allow you to come out that like that? Go ahead.
Well, I'll answer the second question first. Okay. The real question is, would Prince be signed as a solo artist today? Because really, he was signed first and the band came after. Mm-hmm. The real issue today, and I'm not saying anything that a lot of my friends that, you know, are executives of different companies would say, the development side of the record business, which is the record business is different than the music entertainment business. They're related, but they're separate. The development aspect of that went away. The business became dependent on the quick turn and, you know, first week sound scan and, you know, hit driven this and hit driven that. So the days of, you know, breaking through on your third or fourth record, it's rare. Although, I mean, are there still instances of it? Yeah, there's a band called Kings of Leon. RCA stuck with them and, mm-hmm. you know, it was their third record where they broke through. In fact, they live here in Nash, Vegas in my adopted hometown and now we share the same attorney and whatever else. But I think the real key is that now the development portion of it is incumbent upon people other than the labels. What happens now is who does the best job of developing and building and then being able to present something that's fully formed, they have the best shot at being a viable option for major labels. I don't buy into the whole, you know, the record business is dead and major labels are going to completely go away. That's nonsense. But it is radically different in terms of the development phase of it. Is that's probably never going to be the way it once was. And then the first part of the question, I'm going to have you repeat that because I elaborated so much on the second part, I forgot the first part.
You kind of answered, but I was your take on where the business is right now, and you kind of spoke on that. Well, I was going to ask, you know, you said you're in the business end of it with the label, it sounds like, but do you, and so that kind of my frame, how you answer the question, but as an artist, do you think an artist should pursue getting signed immediately, or should they just like take advantage of the different things that are out there and get their own thing going and then maybe come in a partnership with the label if they need to do that? I mean, does that seem realistic to you?
Well, one of the things that my company does now, one of our divisions, is consulting artists, but based on a model that I constructed just based on 40 years' experience of really creating a blueprint, a custom blueprint for pursuing one's career that's based on the realities of who you are, what you do, what the business really is, how it really works, and not, you know, engaging in what I call identity theft. I mean, there's not this one-size-fits-all approach to, you know, to quote-unquote getting there. And for years, that's been the narrative, but it's been incorrect. Everybody thought, well, you do a demo and you send it around, and some A&R guy goes, you know, bring me this kid, and, you know, they give you a deal and then you live happily ever after. Well, it's really never been like that. Was it more like that in 1979 than now? Yeah. But bottom line is it's about creating value like it is in any business, in any industry. If you create value, then you are more likely to be able to attract investment and partners and whatever. Not everybody should. It's never been a world where everybody should pursue a record deal. It's less so now. Because the record business, again, is different than the music entertainment business. But at the end of the day, what it's about is finding, building, and maintaining an audience at any level. If you're the guy that works as an electrical engineer during the week and plays at the blues club every Saturday night, or whether you're Lady Gaga, still about finding, building, and retaining an audience. Okay. There are certain acts that are more compatible with the record industry model, which is built on selling records, period. But there are other people who are just as viable that, you know, don't really fit that. If you're 38 years old, you're not going to get a record deal unless you're already selling a lot of records. In which case, it begs the question, what do you need a record deal for anyway? But that doesn't fit the template. The template is if you're between the ages of, you know, 14 and 22, you know.
Yeah, I get you, and I hate that because, you know, coming from out of the 80s, there was grown men who were singers, and then there were the young guys too. But at the same point, you had grown ass men that was getting down, and was obviously the experience was made the music that much more better. But that's a whole other conversation. 5 minutes, just two questions, and we're done. What is it gonna take? All right. What is it gonna take for yourself? You mentioned Bobby Z. When are we going to get this super group, you know, thing? Some of you guys from Minneapolis and back in the day come together and get out on the road and do it. Is that ever a possibility?
Well, I mean, in all reality, there are conversations going on now with five of us from the original group. I guess that's the official, unofficial announcement of that. We're in the very preliminary stages, a lot of, you know, hurdles to get over, details to work out. But the good news is that the willingness and the desire to do it is there. We were all on a conference call just last week.
Oh, okay.
And there's also another side project that I'm personally involved with. It's more, it's Minneapolis-based, but it's cross-genre, in that there's a one person from kind of the Prince background, et cetera, that's involved, and then another good friend, mutual friend, who was half of a band called the Rembrandts that wrote the theme to the Friends TV show and had some pretty huge success back in the 90s. Oh, okay. And that's a whole other kind of a more rock-oriented side project that I'm involved in. But yeah, back to the original question, that's in the works. I mean, we'll see. You know, that may end up being like Modern Era. It may never come out, but,
we'll see. Well, let me just speak for the whole fan community. We are ready and waiting. So whatever we got to do to help y'all get that going, we're waiting for you. So don't let anything else.
Well, at some point we may call on everybody to mobilize.
Hey,
you know, if you want this to happen, you know, join this Facebook site or
sure,
whatever.
Sure, sure. It's time. And lastly, I thank you for staying on here as long. Just your opinions, if you have heard. What do you think of Prince's latest album, 2010?
You know what? Haven't heard it yet, believe it or not.
Okay.
Have not heard it. And it's funny because it's one of those things where I think that pretty much with any sort of a band or sort of artist entity where there's a long linear history, mm-hmm. I think it's almost human nature at the point where you kind of step off the bus, you don't pay as close attention to where the bus goes after you're off
sure.
of it.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm a much more still a fan, but a much more casual fan than most people would think. And a lot of the stuff I kind of hear, you know, in trickles over time, as opposed to, oh, it just came out, I got to check it out. I mean, I have not heard one thing off it other than, you know, a fleeting little bit here in the background or whatever. But,
So I
don't have an opinion on it.
All right. Well, thank you, Des Dickerson, for coming on here again. It was an honor and a pleasure. We've been hyping this up and talking about it internally, this interview, a lot. And let me say, you just blew it out of the water. So thanks again for coming on the show, man. I really appreciate it. Also, again, we want to make sure and encourage everybody to go to DesDickerson.com, is your site?
DesDickerson.com, yeah.
And buy the book.
If you haven't read the book yet, you got to read it.
It's essential. I mean, we go out and buy all these other Prince books, so we want to make sure we buy the Prince book that's coming from one of the guys who was in the revolution, who was there from the beginning. We want to support this book as well. So, again, everybody, please go buy this book. It is a great one. And any last things you want to throw out there, Des, for people to contact you or what they should be looking out for you?
Two things. I would say just a little bit of housekeeping. I don't know when the podcast will be available, but the site will be down for maintenance until this Saturday, which is, what would it make be this Saturday, the 20-something here. But other than that, you know, there's also my Facebook page. I don't have a fan page, but a personal page. And just keep it locked, stay in touch, and we'll keep you posted.
All right. You've been listening to the Prince Podcast on freedomtrain.com. It's your host, Michael Dean. Have a blessed day. We'll talk to you guys next time.